Up next on Boston Public Radio, John King from CNN joins us to discuss how recent court rulings and immigration reform may impact the Republican Party's presidential plans. Then, student interest rates on loans are doubling. What do we do now? Our guest has some answers on that. Callie Crossey tells us about her movie night extraordinaire at Chestnut Hill's new Showcase Superlux. Charlie Baker may tell us he's running for governor today. Then again, he may not. Victims' rights advocate Wendy Murphy addresses the growing trend of defendants hiding their faces in court. And Jonathan Alsop tells us everything we need to know about wine sipping this 4th of July. All that is up next on Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is on vacation. I'm joined in the studio by Callie Crossley, the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which airs Sundays at 6:30 on WGBH Radio.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Callie.
Hi, Marjorie.
Excited about the 4th of July, Callie?
Sure. Why not?
Okay, why not? We are joined now on the lines, we are every Tuesday at noontime, by CNN's John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to the 4th of July.
Well, you know, I'm glad you said that, John, because before we get to the political issues of the day, you're a Dorchester boy. Massachusetts is one of only four states in the entire nation that outlaws fireworks. Now, I bet there was a sparkler back there in your undisciplined youth back there on the wild streets of Dorchester. Should we legalize fireworks in Massachusetts? What do you think, John?
Oh, God, you're asking me this now. As a Dorchester kid or as a parent, you know, so I'm conflicted on this. The old me says, absolutely. The current me says, oh, that's a little risky. You know, I ended up in Kearney Hospital once on the 4th of July because we built such a huge bonfire at Wainwright Park, and we poured a little gasoline on it to get it going. It was a cloudy, rainy, misty day, and so I'm probably a living example of why people should stay away from matches on the 4th of July.
What happened? What happened? You burned your face, your hands?
Wow.
What'd you burn?
Got a nice little gash in my forehead. You can still see it if you take a look. I still got a little scar there. Mom and Dad loved picking me up at Kearney. They got the, you know, that was the days before cell phones. I'm dating myself. Somebody ran to the home and said, oh, Mrs. King, Johnny just got his head blown open.
Oh, my God.
It was just a few stitches. I was fine, but
okay.
It looks pretty good at the moment.
Well, how about a couple of sparklers, John? I'm not talking about bonfires and huge combustible things. What about a couple of sparklers for the kiddos? What do you think?
I think, you know, with proper parental supervision, maybe we can find a middle ground.
Okay.
But, you know, this is the kids' version of, you know, trying to have gun control legislation. I mean, you know, what's a reasonable middle ground, Marjorie?
Okay. Sparklers, that's my reasonable middle ground. Sure. But let's move on to some political questions, John. You know, conventionalism says the GOP has big problems in the 2016 presidential race because they're far right, a very conservative stance on abortion and gay rights and immigration. The first of them, of course, are hurting them with social liberals, the last two with Latino voters. There was a great piece in the New York Times either today or yesterday talking about all these deep-pocketed GOP groups are offering cover and running all these huge ads and giving great support for their rising stars like, you know, Mark Rubio, the senator from Florida, or New Hampshire's Kelly Ayotte, who supported immigration. This seems to be a good thing for possible immigration reform, maybe a good thing for the GOP in 2016, it seems to me.
It's tough. I'm not sure if even if they pass a bill with a path to citizenship, which is still a huge question mark because of the House. The House would pass a bill because the Republicans run the House. I can see a bill with legal status or, you know, a modest path to citizenship coming out of the House. But then can they reconcile that with the Senate? Can they make a deal with the president? Possible. It's more possible than it has been in years. But I would still put a huge question mark over immigration reform. But if you look, there's a new poll out today. You know, Hillary Clinton versus Marco Rubio race, where the numbers among Latinos are almost identical to the Obama versus Romney race, in the sense that, you know, remember Rubio's Cuban, and some of the other Latino communities think, you know, the Cubans get all these benefits, which they do get more benefits than other. You know, if you're Cuban and you settle on American soil, bang, you're in. So there's a long way to go. Is this one bill going to solve the Republicans' problem with the Latinos? No. Is it a down payment? Is it something the party should think hard about doing because they need to at least make a down payment? Absolutely. That's a fascinating question. Now, in a very close race, they don't have to, you know, get George W. Bush's 40% or 44% in 2016 to win. They need to get above 30, and Romney was under. Romney's at 28%. I mean, that's pretty bad among Latinos. But let me play contrarian. When a party controls the White House for 8 years, the other guys almost always win. In our lifetime, George H.W. Bush is the only person elected president following of the same party. You know, following Ronald, he followed Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
So history says the Republicans should win in 2016, which is one of the reasons Democrats so desperately want Hillary Clinton to run, because they think the rest of their field is weak.
Well, should win is one thing, John King, it's Callie Crossley, but when there are obvious ways to embrace that which they seem not to have embraced in the past. I'm thinking about, you know, of course, here in Massachusetts, Gabriel Gomez just lost. The Republican Party really did not throw him much love, as the kids would say. They gave him no money. They didn't come in the same way that the Democratic folks came in for Markey. Now, you could say maybe this was a done deal. But if they had, that's an expression of saying, hey, this is our guy. He represents everything that we want, and he's Latino. And I think that speaks volume, even if you decide to vote against an immigration bill that you feel doesn't have everything in it.
I think that's an interesting and it's important perspective, in the sense that sometimes you make an investment, even though you think you're going to lose in politics. You don't do this with your money. You don't want to throw your money away. But in politics, you can always get more money. You can make that investment to make a point. And the Republican Party probably could have done a better message in Massachusetts, A, to try to rebuild its infrastructure in Massachusetts, but B, to send a national message. Look, here we're trying. We're going to do everything we can to try to help this guy. Coming out of the presidential election, this was not Brown versus Coakley. The Republicans knew that all along. They didn't think they could win without a miracle. So part of that was marshaling your resources for other big races. But there's no question they could have at least planted a stiffer flag. They didn't plant much of one at all there.
And the reason I bring that up is because it's not far afield from the immigration reform bill, because if you haven't made that investment, that obvious investment in this case, then it seems to me you have a little bit more ground to stand on to express what some people seem to think should not be issues in getting this immigration reform bill through, shouldn't be the obstacles in stopping that.
Right, and I think that words alone won't matter, and I don't even think even if they pass this bill, one big bill wouldn't be enough. And look, the Republicans, what they've done in the last week or so is guarantee. Let's assume this bill passes. Let's assume Marco Rubio becomes a hero, or at least a popular figure among Latinos nationally for being the conservative who tried to get this through the Senate. And let's assume he gets it to the president's desk. What happened in the past week? Rob Portman, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, three guys thinking about running for president. Rand Paul is definitely running in 2016. Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, has been in New Hampshire recently. They voted no. So the Republicans have guaranteed, even if this bill passes, in 2016, we're going to have the same debate we just had in 2012. And I'll give you two of Mitt Romney's words to tell you how well that worked for the Republicans. Those two words would be self-deport.
Oh, God, remember that.
So they're going to have this debate again. No matter what happens with this debate, it looks like the Republican primary in 2016 will revisit this.
But the reason I asked you about the big-pocketed Republicans supporting people like Rubio, who's sticking his neck out here on this immigration reform, is I just thought it was interesting that, say, the Chamber of Commerce, which just started a million-dollar-plus ad for Republicans supporting immigration, have realized they're on the side of immigration reform. They've realized it's important. So maybe even though the House is totally different, there's much more opposition to immigration in the House, the money backers of the GOP have realized they've got to change or they're stuck forever.
Right, and there's still a civil war within the party on this issue, where you have the Chamber of Commerce. You have the Chamber of Commerce was for Bush, McCain, Kennedy. They have long wanted this issue. They want the workers. Some people say it's cynical and they want lower cost labor. Whatever your position on that, the Chamber of Commerce has long been on record for this. But you still have groups like the Heritage Foundation. You have a lot of grassroots Republican organizations saying no. A lot of some Tea Party groups say yes. Some say no. So this remains a tug of war. When a party's out of power, this is when you have what I call the circular firing squad. And the Democrats went through this in the 70s and the 80s, and the Republicans are going through it now that they're out of power. And this struggle is pretty fierce within the party. And so you're going to have this grassroots fight. And how's that going to play out? It'll play out in some primaries in 2014. Republicans who vote yes on this, some of them will face primaries in 2014 that are about this. And some Republicans who vote no might face primaries from Republicans who say, hey, we've got to pass this bill. What's the problem? But what it guarantees is that it stays a fight within the Republican Party. Now, I want to just make one more point when you look ahead to 2016. Nationally, the Republican Party is a mess right now. There's no question about that. But I would remind people there are still 30 Republican governors. in this country, or the 50 states. Mm-hmm. So some Republicans are winning at the state level. Now, those Republicans couldn't win if we beamed them into Massachusetts because the politics are so different. But when you're looking at the Electoral College map, yes, it still favors the Democrats, but I can give you a scenario for a Republican victory, especially if the Democrats nominate somebody who's as left or perhaps even more left than President Obama.
Did you see what Sarah Palin, who apparently is leading the anti-immigration reform charge, you see what she called Rubio? Judas. So I guess she has no use for him. And talk radio has been really brutal. Glenn Beck called him some nasty names as well. But let's move on to the Supreme Court decisions. John King from CNN. You know, of course, last week the Supreme Court ruled that defining marriage between a man and a woman is unconstitutional. So again, I hate to obsess so much about the 2016 race, but I can't help it. This is another dilemma, it would seem to me, for the GOP nationally, when you have the Supreme Court saying federal law, you know, upholding federal law, a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman. What does the GOP do about this?
Well, again, they're going to have this debate amongst themselves. And if you go back, you know, you had, Rand Paul became the new Rick Santorum, you know, giving a thing about what's next, you know, and his staff said he was being sarcastic, but what's next, you know, relationships between humans and animals. So some of the rhetoric guarantees that people are going to look at them and scratch their head and say, he said what? No matter what your position is on same-sex marriage, you have people look at it and say, what? But then, you know, so again, you have this fight, which we had between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's position was it should be up to the state. If the state passes same-sex marriage either through referendum or through the legislature, that's okay with him. Now, he has a gay daughter, and Dick Cheney, whatever you think of him, if you go back to his congressional record, actually was a pioneer in terms of having openly gay people on his staff back then. So you might say he has more of a understanding of these issues. But they're going to fight this out. Remember, George W. Bush in 2004 was for a constitutional amendment, and Dick Cheney was on the ticket with him, so he just shut his mouth. His job was to support the president. We're going to have this fight now, and if you look, we haven't gotten the big decision. What does the Supreme Court think up or down on the issue of same-sex marriage? You know, it sent the California case back on a standing issue. It overturned the federal law, DOMA. But what that guarantees is now, as the president and the administration try to decide what happens if you're a same-sex couple married legally in Massachusetts, you can now file a joint tax return. You can now, you know, get survivor's benefits and things like that. But what if you're a same-sex couple in Mississippi, who you're not married because you can't be in that state, or you were married in New York or Massachusetts, but Mississippi doesn't recognize that? Can they file a joint tax return? And if they can't, are they being discriminated against at the federal level? So this one's going to come back to the courts. Again, as we play through the 2014 and then the 2016 campaign, not only will this be an issue anyway, but there will be some big court cases pressing at the time that will be flashpoints, no question.
So how about Wendy Davis, John King from CNN? She's the, of course, if people don't know that, she's the become a progressive hero and a pro-choice hero all across America, if you're on that side. Because last Tuesday, she stood up there in the Texas legislature for 13 hours in this filibuster when they were trying to put more restrictions on abortion. I thought in Texas, and you're in Texas quite a bit. I mean, I haven't been to Texas.
I'm in Texas right now.
Okay. Mm. Are you covering this? Are you down there because of Wendy Davis?
One of the things I'm watching, yeah.
Well, I thought it was extraordinary that she got this tremendous support. It was mostly women in the crowd. But it was a show of force, I thought, for pro-choice forces in Texas. And again, she's become this YouTube heroine. This is another dilemma. If Texas can show this kind of show of force, I know that. Well, what's happening? Rick Perry, the governor down there, is going to file new legislation. Is it next week about abortion
rights?
They're
back in. The special session is back in, and so within a few days they will get back to that. They have 30 days to do it, but they're expected to do it within a couple of days or within a week or two at the most. And it looks like they have the votes. Look, if she hadn't done that filibuster, they did have the votes to pass it. They couldn't pass it because they couldn't get their act together, and the clock expired on them, essentially. They had to do it by midnight, and they did it at, 12:03 or 12:04.
Yeah.
So they have the votes to do it. And then the question is, again, this is how we litigate things. The legislature does something, and then the people get to reflect in the next election. She says she's now going to look again. If she might run for governor in the Democratic primary to challenge Perry. Perry's been governor for 12, going on 13 years now. He suffered a bit when he ran for president here. People didn't like that. He's running for re-election. Can a pro-choice woman Democrat be elected governor of Texas? Well, Ann Richards was. Texas was ahead of the arc, if you will, in electing a woman governor.
That's a great point.
She was a dynamic.
How did that happen?
She was a dynamic politician who didn't have the best opponent, and the combination of her being a great politician and not having the strongest opponent, she was able to win. And then George W. Bush beat her. And so can Could somebody like Senator Davis be the next governor of Texas? Yes. Is it likely? Probably not yet. Texas has become a more Republican state since Ann Richards left office.
Yes, but John King also...
But it's possible.
But also, John King, it also has become a more Latino state.
Yes.
The demographics in that state have changed radically. So we're talking about those twin brothers whose name are escaping me, Julian and his brother.
Castro brothers.
Right, the Castro brothers. One of them's in the legislature.
The good Castro brothers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. And just to make that clear, the very good Castro brothers. So you've got that going on there. And you have, obviously, even if in some small way, a vocal support of a Wendy Davis. Does that not suggest, if not a new Texas, a reform Texas on the horizon?
There's a changing Texas. And one of the things you have to notice, you look nationally at the Republican Party among Latinos, and they have more than a crisis. They have a disaster on their hands. Here in Texas, because of Governor Bush and even Governor Perry, have done much better among Latinos than their national counterparts. However, because of the national party message has hurt even Texas Republicans who you would say, have a quote-unquote good record on Latino issues, whether it's immigration, whether it's economic development, whether it's other issues of interest to the community. They have suffered some because their national party has such a black eye. So there's no question, changing demographics, and sometimes just when you have a guy who's been in office for a long time, there's an opportunity for Democrats. Is it there in the next election, or is it 2 or 4 or 6 years away because of the demographic arc? Who knows? But they have a better chance now than they had 2 years or 4 years ago. You can bet on that. The question is the moment right? And can you get a good politician who I'd like an Ann Richards, who probably should not have won that first race, but she did. She made the difference. She found in her own campaign style and her own message, that extra point or two to win. That's why people will pay attention to the next governor's race here, no question.
And her daughter is now running Planned Parenthood. Celine Richards, and Ann Richards was a phenomenal speaker and very powerful for women in recovery.
Absolutely.
From alcoholism as well. Hey, John King, national correspondent for CNN. You guys on CNN have been doing wall-to-wall coverage of the Trayvon Martin case. I've been watching it at night. It's been absolutely fascinating. Any thoughts on what may happen there?
No, I don't want to say what's going to happen there, but I love watching it. When I first started working for the Associated Press, both in Providence and then in Boston, I got to cover some trials. I don't get to do that much in Washington. So I'm always fascinated. I covered part of the Sussman Bulow retrial and the appeal hearings there. So I'm always fascinated to watch a trial. And it's clear to me that the defense is just trying to plant seeds of reasonable doubt.
I should point out, excuse me, I didn't say that. Trayvon Martin was a young man, 16 or 17 years old. Was he 16 or 17?
16.
When he was shot to death by George Zimmerman, and George Zimmerman was a self-appointed neighborhood watch guy. And there's obviously racial implications here, since that George Zimmerman possibly went after Trayvon Martin because he had a hoodie on, tall black kid in the neighborhood. George Zimmerman, of course, is saying that he had the right under Florida's law, that stand your ground law, that he thought he was in danger and he had the right to shoot him. But I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
No, and so it's a highly charged case anyway, and then you throw in the racial issues, which are unavoidable in this state. So in this case, and so it's been a fascinating trial to watch, and I'm always watching for. I'm just always thinking strategy in this, and it's just clear to me. I thought the defense lawyer who started off with that knock knock joke and that went so flat, I thought that was horrible. And so the first day you think, well, the first day was a good day for the prosecution, in part because of their case and in part because of that horrible joke. In the parts I've been able to watch, I've watched quite a bit of it. I do think that both sides have had their moments where you say, that was good testimony, or that was a good line of questioning. But you can see the defense, especially when they were interviewing the lead detective the other day, George Zimmerman told you this, and you later found a witness who said the same thing. George Zimmerman told you this, you later found a witness who said the same thing. They are trying to plant at the end, they don't, it's obvious he admits killing Trayvon Martin. They just need to find reasonable doubt to the idea that, and try to convince this jury. Just even if they're not positive, even if the jury doesn't 100% agree that it was self-defense, they just have to be, unclear. And that's what the defense is trying to do, plant seeds of doubt.
Have there been major stumbles, do you think, by the defense? I mean, right before the trial started, his attorneys had to admit that they had made an error. A couple things that they tried to get inserted into the trial, the judge said no. So I'm wondering if it's their job to try to plant reasonable doubt. But I wonder if they started behind the eight ball.
I do think there were some mistakes. I don't want to call them amateur. I'm not there, but I do think they, you know, didn't dot some I's and cross some T's that they probably should have spent some more time pre-trial thinking about. I think the prosecution's also made a couple of mistakes. What always fascinates me about covering trials, though, is that, you know, we watch them, and then you talk to the jurors after, whether the verdict is a surprise to you or not, and you say, what did it? What was the thing that swung? And it's almost always something that, you know, that the media or the people who have expertise in legal matters, they'll say, that was a great day, that was this. And, you know, you don't always get in the Bombulo trial, it was no insulin injection. In OJ, it was, if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Yeah. So you don't always get those, you don't get those TV moments most of the time. You get a pretty mundane, often boring back and forth about, you know, two guys wrestling in the dark and a gun goes off and nobody could really see it that clearly. What are the eyewitness accounts? The jurors often will say, this is what decided it, and it has, you know, it's not what the headline has been in the newspaper. So I'm just waiting to see how this one plays out. It is fascinating to watch.
Oh, it has been fascinating to watch, and I'm thrilled that you guys have had it on CNN every single night. John King, as always, great to have you here. John King is chief national correspondent for CNN. Thanks, John.
Happy 4th, no bonfires.
Happy 4th to you, too. And John King joins us every Tuesday at noon. Okay, coming up, interest rates on federal staffer loans doubled yesterday after Congress, surprise, surprise, failed to act. As tuition rates rise and rise some more, it's bad news for cash-strapped students and a lot of their parents who are taking care of these loans for their kids. We're going to talk about it next and hopefully get some answers on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Saturday, July 13th at 7 p.m., it's the first ever WGBH Craft Beer Festival, right outside our studios in Brighton. Enjoy some of New England's finest brews from Boston Beer Works, Smutty Nose, Pretty Things, and plenty of others. Learn about the craft of beer making from expert beer masters. There's even food from some of the best food truck vendors in town and live entertainment on the main stage. For tickets and more information, visit wgbh.org/events.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Boston Conservatory, proud sponsor of the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, solely focused on training the performing arts superstars of tomorrow in dance, music, musical theater, and opera. bostonconservatory.edu. And Genuine Interactive, a full-service interactive agency that creates digital strategies, mobile apps, and social media strategies for local and national brands. You can learn more about this Boston-based agency at genuineinteractive.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is on vacation. I am Marjorie Egan, and Callie Crossley is joining me in studio. So higher education, as most of us know, is totally dependent on student loans. In fact, at state schools like UMass Boston and Lowell, more than half of tuition is financed by loans. Yet, according to various sources, only 39% of borrowers are making their loan payments on time, which obviously means most aren't. And this is before, because of congressional inaction, basically, interest rates on loans doubled from 3.4% to 6.8%. We're going to take your calls on this mess in just a couple of minutes. But first, we're joined by a man who I hope can give us some answers, those of us drowning in debt or the kids who are drowning in debt, and in many cases, the parents who are drowning in debt trying to take care of their kids. Bob Hildreth is the founder of Fuel Education in Boston. It's a program designed to prepare students and families for college. Bob, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure, Marjorie.
So you think, Bob, that things are in such a desperate state that we're about to have loan forgiveness? Could this actually be true, Bob?
I think we're having it now in the ways the federal government are coming up with a program almost once a week to try to help, but ultimately hide the inability of 37 million student borrowers to pay their debts. It's just the cows have left the barn. It's too late now. We're all concerned about this interest rate going up, and we should be, because it sounds like a great deal to double. But in fact, it's like that little chair on top of the elephant. It's about $4,000 bucks of added interest costs on an average loan that of about $33,000, which each student has nowadays. So if the student isn't going to pay the $33,000, then the extra $4,000 just is beyond the point.
Bob Hildreth, I'm Callie Crossley, and of course, that is an important point that you've just made. If you don't have any of it, you know, additional is not going to it's not going to do anything but make things worse. But I want to just for a point of clarification, as I understand it, this new increase applies to new loans. But I'm not quite sure I understand what a new loan is. So if you currently have a Stafford loan, you know, for last year, let's say you were a junior, now you're a senior this year. Does that mean your Stafford loan is now new as a senior because you didn't have the same one when you were a junior and therefore you're paying the higher interest rate? Or is it really a completely new loan? You had no Stafford loan and now you have one and that's the new rate you're paying?
That's correct. It's the second.
Okay. Because that was going to be even more horrific.
So that means everybody's rate is not jumping to six if they have loans if they're a junior or senior. It's the kids that are getting it, the freshmen and sophomores, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And one of the things that's interesting here, there are so many new developments. Sallie Mae is splitting in half, splitting in two, I mean. And they want to push the non-Stafford loans, which are growing like crazy, which have much higher interest rates.
Hmm.
So this is a very... the interest rates are spread all over in student loans.
But you said before, Bob, that you thought we're getting to the point where people are going to be there's going to be loan debt forgiveness, and you said we're already there. Is this because people are defaulting already? I mean, I think a lot of people who are heavily in debt now would be very happy to know that their loans are shortly going to be forgiven. I mean, what does that mean, and when is this going to happen?
Except if just let me add to that and say, but if in this way of loan forgiveness, which is by default, it means then you cannot get a house,
right.
You can't get a car, some other things, right? So you're prevented from really living your life. It's not an easy way out.
Correct. Well, one of the things the government did at the beginning of the year, they said, okay, you can't pay your loans under the Stafford loan terms, which is a 10-year loan. So we're going to extend your obligations all the way until you're 60 years old. And we are going to make them income-based. So you can only pay X percent of what you make in any year. Sounds good. However, the first thing is it goes on forever. And the second thing, and this is all debt forgiveness, remember, because you're not paying what you owe, but you're only paying a certain percent of what you can pay. At the end, there's a bubble. And that bubble is what you haven't paid. Well, it's forgiven. But it's a gift. So the government makes you pay the tax on that gift at 35%. For many people, at the age of 60, it's going to really screw up their retirement.
So but we're talking semi-forgiveness then. We're not talking real, like you're off the hook forgiveness.
Right.
But that's the beginning.
Okay.
I'm saying we already have some forms of forgiveness coming in. Now, we have another kind of, as you said, forgiveness, which is by default. Now, that is growing very, very fast. The government doesn't like it, but there's an industry, a cottage industry of people that the government pays to chase after us who don't pay our loans back. They kind of cluster around towns where there's very little business, like up in New York State. And these people take your cars, and they take your homes, and they garnish your wages. And
for student loans, not paid?
For student loans.
Absolutely.
Just for student
yeah.
loans. Mm-hmm. And the default rate has doubled. Speaking of things that
what is
doubled.
It? What is it, the default rate?
It's 9.1. And
okay.
5 years ago, it was 4.5.
And that's because it's so high already.
Right. But now, add to that a much larger group of people who are about 3 to 5 years in lousy payments. They haven't paid on time. Those people are about to go into default, but they're not considered default figures. Add to those people who are about 1 year, 90 days to 1 year. And you know, Marjorie and so forth, you know what it's like to be 90 days over on a loan. You start getting calls,
phone
right?
calls. I know. Everyone loves those calls. Yeah. Loves those calls. Well, but Bob, one last question for me. So what is the solution? I mean, we have a bunch of bills that have been put through. No one's getting anywhere on the bills. You know, Congress didn't act on to avoid this doubling. People are heavily in debt, not able to pay. You know, they're not getting good jobs, not able to pay all these. So what do we do? I mean, is it just... The Congress.
Do you remember about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, what the government did to hospitals and radically decreasing the
no.
amounts they could pay?
I don't.
Oh, well, you know, like an appendectomy, they were charging like $20,000.
Oh, okay.
And if you wanted a Medicare payment, you got only $5,000 for
yep.
it?
Okay.
Okay. Well, the government's going to do something very similar to tuitions with colleges. They're going to say, if you want continued access to Pell Grants and student loans, you have to decrease radically your tuitions. So that's one part of the solution. The other part of the solution, forgive my humility, but it's programs like I'm running called Fuel. Fuel says, hey, we all have to save more for college. And if that means you're low income, which we focus on, it's possible if you start doing it soon and if you get the courses that we give that gives you the information about why you have to do it. This will not be solved without a lot more savings going into college tuition payments.
Yeah. Well, one last thing. This is the last thing, Bob. College tuitions have gone through the roof, and I've got three kids, ran around to all these different colleges to visit, and, you know, you go to these cafeterias that get sushi bars, they're open until 2 o'clock in the morning, with 17 different varieties of, you know, exotic food. You get these gyms that look like something that could be in the Olympic Village. I mean, part of the reason that tuitions are through the roof, I know it's salaries and administrative costs and so forth, but I don't know that we need to have this kind of extravagance at some of these colleges, who I assume are competing against each other. But I don't think it would be so terrible if college tuitions went down and the colleges were a little bit more frugal in what they spend their money on.
So that's where the informed consumer comes in. We had 15 families in Lynn this 2 months ago who all of their kids got into prestige colleges like Suffolk and so forth. They all went to local state schools. Why?
Because they could pay.
Because, right. Yes. Would they have done that 10 years ago?
No. Okay. Okay, yeah. Bob Hildreth, this is very depressing, but I thank you nonetheless. Well, for joining. Oh, go ahead, Callie.
Just one last question,
sorry.
Bob. I word on the street is that this is going to be reversed because none of these congresspersons wants to go home and face folks who really understand this. This is an issue that most people can understand and say, ha-ha, yes, I did not fight to keep those interest rates down. Are you hearing that?
Yes, I'm hearing that. Unfortunately, for the first time, this has gotten into the bipartisan bucket. So they're going to have several opportunities during the month of July to reverse this. But the decision is going to be right at the cutting edge of what the Democrats and Republicans are fighting over, and that is, how are you going to finance the subsidy?
Okay.
Bob Hildreth, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I hate being a doomsayer.
That's okay. It just is depressing because I think that everybody's so in debt. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to fix this anytime soon, but maybe we will. I hope you're right. Bob Hildreth, is the founder of Fuel Education in Boston, a program designed to prepare students and families for college. You can see what their program is all about at fueleducation.org. And Bob, thanks again. Okay, our number. 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. How are you managing this in your life? I think a lot of grown-ups are helping their kids pay off these student loans because their kids get out of school, can't find jobs. What are they going to do? Mom and dad step in. Mom and dad, of course, haven't paid enough toward their retirement, so they're really squished in this box. 877-301-8970. Do you get these calls? Are you worried about defaulting on your loans? And again, how many parents out there have taken up the slack for their kids? 877-301-8970, bpr@wgbh.org. I mean, I hear about this all the time, Callie Crossley, that you know, you get out of school, you spent $50,000, $75,000 on an education, and then You can't get a job.
That's right.
You can't get a job. So you're living in the basement. Jim Brad always makes fun of these kids for living in the basement. They're living in the basement because they can't afford an apartment and pay their student loans.
Yeah, one more year for my niece and nephew. Both of them are going into senior year, and it's very scary.
What's also very scary is that you hear people say, oh, well, college is the new high school. So what does that mean? We have to go to graduate school now?
Yeah.
I mean, how much is it going to cost to get your PhD in sociology or anthropology or even your master's degree? That's another massive investment.
Well, here's the other thing. A lot of people are going to get their graduate degrees or going to school, period, because they can't find jobs. It's become the alternative to not finding jobs because what? They can get loans to go to school. That's right. And now they're further and further in debt.
Yeah. So then instead of being $50,000 in debt, I think the average is around
$30,000. Yeah, yeah.
But if you pursue graduate school, you could be up to $100,000
before you
turn around. 877-301-8970. What should be done? I'm not confident that anything is going to be done, but I do think that we're getting part of the problem here is that because these schools know kids are going to get loans, they do have the sushi bars and they do have the treadmills with little computers on top of all the treadmills. I mean, have you been to Providence College lately?
Yes. Now, in fairness, a lot of that has to do with they are all competing for that little tiny pool of the most elite students, thinking that, you know, these accoutrements are going to draw them. And
but
maybe
they're expensive.
Do.
They're expensive.
They absolutely are.
Yeah.
But a large part of that, too, is also the payment of the faculty, because the faculty are a big piece for some students about why they choose certain schools. And if you want to get your prestigious faculty, you got to pay them.
I guess.
You know?
How much do you have to pay them, though?
I don't know. Now, that's another question.
We all threw around in the Scott Brown, Elizabeth Warren race that she was making $350,000 for teaching one course. It was, however, at Harvard Law School, which is la creme de la creme, and you have to pay lawyers a lot more money.
Right.
I don't know. Should you pay college professors $250,000? Did they get $250,000? The highest paid people in Massachusetts in the state employment list are all at UMass Amherst.
Well, remember that. And also remember that the adjunct professors, who are the people who are not get the big professors are, you know, have had their benefits cut, had their time cut. So it's a really interesting dilemma as colleges try to figure out, well, how can we throw the sushi bar in there, get the best faculty and attract the most elite students to be competitive.
Ryan in Newton, what do you think about this mess, Ryan? Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks. My girlfriend is a teacher and she has a substantial amount of debt at the moment. I was aware that a couple of years ago, I thought Obama passed something where if a teacher worked in a public school or for public funding for 10 years and paid a certain percentage, her federal debt would be wiped clean. I was just wondering if that was true or not.
Oh, yeah. There are certain public service jobs that you can go into. And I don't know if it's going to take it all, Ryan, but I know it's going to take some. One of the problems with that is that probably in those public service jobs, you're not going to be making a lot of money. So it's going to be harder for you to pay back those debts. But yeah, I know that people do get forgiven depending on what they do. So she's right. I don't know how much it is.
I think that's one of the good programs. But again, you know, these are not people that are making a lot of money on the other side.
Yeah. Well, a lot of kids go into AmeriCorps.
Yeah.
And volunteer
mm-hmm.
programs. And you do get a place to live in a lot of these deals, mm-hmm. and you get postponed in paying back your loans. But what do you get, $10,000 a year or something? You're not going to get far on $10,000 a year, are you? Maybe it's up to 15 now.
Depending on where you live.
Dave in the car, what do you think about the student loan mess?
Yeah, it's just crazy. I get two of my kids. I sent them back to where I'm from originally. I never thought I would have to do that.
Where's that?
And I am from a small island. It's called Mauritius. It's next to Africa, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. And the government spends almost 14% of the GDP in education. So 90% is paid. Both kids, one gets his electrical engineering for $18,000, and the other one gets a bachelor in biology, combined, $30,000.
Wow. Now, how difficult was it for them to get educated in a different country and then come back here? Maybe they didn't come back here. Did it affect their job prospects?
They're still over there. Actually, one wants to stay and work there for the marine science. But it was kind of easy for me because I have a dual citizenship. And
okay.
The only problem, actually, the high school there, it's still from England. the matriculation board. So they, when they finished high school here, they had to study another year and a half to get admitted in the university there.
Oh, wow. So it's not perfect. Yeah. It's not a perfect situation. Dave, thank you for the call. You know, people do that, go to Canada, McGill.
I was going to say, I was just talking to somebody from Canada yesterday. Talking about how little he had to pay back because the tuition was, you know, not only reasonable, was very economical.
But it's become astronomically difficult to get into McGill because all these Americans are trying to do the same thing. Ship the kids up. Is it in Toronto? I'm not sure where it is.
Somewhere in
there. Ship them up there to go to school because it's not that far. They can go visit them. They hope they don't stay there. That's one of my big fears. You know,
and let's not forget, McGill is a very good university.
Very good university.
Yeah, right.
But now that it's bargain, it's become really, really difficult to get into. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about student loans, the fact that they are going to double unless Congress does something about this from 3-point-something% to 6.8%, which is a lot of money. And by the way, I did not know that the government gets $51 billion in revenue from student loans by charging more interest than it costs them to borrow. I mean, that's a lot of money. Gabor, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Newton, is it Gabor or Gabor?
Gabor.
Hi, Gabor. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're very welcome. I just wanted to point out that while it is true that some of these facilities are pretty plush, it's also true that there are countless additional buildings being built by all educational institutions, even though the number of students in those institutions have not increased significantly, that a lot of it is just increasing sort of in an imperialistic way the real estate and the holdings of these organizations. And, you know, the only other analogy is the health situation. And both in both cases, the cost of healthcare and the cost of education has far outpaced the rate of inflation. And I think it's because there is just no control. No one is really able to exercise control over these two industries.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is a lot of Republicans' argument, that by feeding the maw, by making these loans more available, you're allowing these universities to just up and up and up the prices without any accountability. And it is kind of crazy when you think about it. I mean, back in the olden days when you and I went to college, I mean, you could
waitress for
the summer and you could get a third of your tuition. I mean, it cost me like $10,000 a year to go to school.
But you could also get grants and not loans.
You could also get grants. That is true. And it's harder and harder and harder to get those grants. Let's squeeze in one more call here. Greg in the car. What do you think, Greg?
Really, two quick things. I worked four or five jobs to go to a Jesuit school here in town that's extraordinarily expensive.
Boston College.
Yeah. And one of the things was I had a Keystone class and I was always late for it. And I got pulled aside by the professor. And he says, I want to know why you're late to my class. And I said, the reason I'm late for your class is because I'm working till 3 in the morning to pay you. So the day you pay me to be on time, I'll be here on time.
Wow.
I don't think there's enough kids working. I really don't.
Now, Greg, hold on. I thought the Jesuits were a cheap deal. Aren't they supposed to come for free? I didn't know we had to pay the Jesuits, Greg. They took their vows of poverty. What?
Ask Jack Connors how he's going to make it cheaper. But that's the problem.
I love Jack Connors. Greg sounds like he's an angry man.
Yeah, well.
About Boston College.
I got to say, I've seen I do a lot of speaking on college campuses. A lot of kids are working. And it's impacting their, you know, trying to get to class on time and trying not to be sleepy and all of that. I mean, he does make a very good point. There are a lot of kids working.
The other thing is that after you spend astronomical dollars to get them off to school, they need spending money, which, you know, is my solution is get a job. But then it's very difficult to get jobs on campus because the kids, you know, the first come, first serve, those go very, very quickly. And so you have to find a job off campus or, you know, whatever. Everybody winds up either working at Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. I think that's how it goes, is it not?
Yes.
Okay, enough about that. Coming up in a minute, this is a great story. And Callie Crossley is going to give us a firsthand report because she was at ground zero. You ready for a draft beer, gourmet sandwiches, even sushi when you go to the movies? We'll see if audiences are ready for the highfalutin, high-class movie experience. We're going to talk about the new Showcase Superlux that just opened in Chestnut Hill. Up next, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Philip Martin. I live here, and I report here.
Without ever knowing it, you've driven the same routes, passed the same landmarks, and used the same rest stops as today's human trafficking networks.
I think I'm always in reporter mode.
Who's orchestrating this trafficking network? from New York to New England.
And it's so important to be aware of the things that are going on in our life and to incorporate that into journalism.
Philip Martin, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the 2013 Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, July 26th, 27th, and 28th in Boston's Copley Square. You can learn more at bostonsummerarts.com. And It's Your Move, Inc., a move management company specializing in the planning, orchestrating, and execution of moves for senior citizens, helping families sort through and organize treasures collected over a lifetime. It'sYourMoveInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Callie Crossley is sitting in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Okay, listen to this. You are greeted by a concierge in a vast circular lobby. You're escorted to a plush leather lounge chair that reclines at the touch of a button, handed an iPad that serves as a menu for Navio's restaurant on site. Cocktails, draft beer, tuna sashimi, beef carpaccio. I hope I pronounced those right. I don't even know. Tuna sashimi, whatever that is. In any case, this is, I just read you from a Joanna Weiss column on Sunday that's describing the super luxe experience, the showcase super luxe, which just opened in Chestnut Hill. And Joanna Weiss went to see that movie. Well, she didn't see the super luxe movie. She saw some other movie. I don't know what movie she saw. She wanted to see The Great Gatsby. She ended up watching something else. But in any case, for $28, she could have martinis, tuna sashimi, or beef carpaccio sitting in her lounge chair. And Callie Crossley went there too. We want to ask you guys at 877-301-8970, is this what you've been looking for in your movie enjoyment? Are you sick of being next to these 12-year-olds with their texting all through in the movies and they're chomping on the popcorn and all that kind of stuff? You don't have to get any popcorn without getting out of your seat, correct?
That is correct.
All right, Callie Crossley, give us your experience. Was it luxurious?
It was luxurious and fabulous for the most part.
Detail.
This is the Chestnut Hill new Superlux cinema.
That's right.
And I had actually been to a showcase cinema, you know, it's called Stadium Seating, Special Seating in Dedham once. And that's a... you know, it's bigger than the one in Chestnut Hill. And that was very lovely. And I did the super luxe experience there and didn't quite know how to do it well. So I ordered and the people came in the middle of the movie. So you have to sort of get that right.
Do you press the button to order?
Yeah, you can press and they come.
Love that.
And
love
it's
that.
Great. This one I think is even, it's smaller, but it's, you know, it seems in terms of its layout to be even more luxurious. And they have another section called Lux Light, which is what I decided to try out because I'd been in Super Lux. It's a few bucks cheaper, but that's not the point.
Okay, wait a minute. Hold on.
Okay.
What's the difference between Super Lux and
Super
Lux Light?
You can order all through the movie if
Oh, okay.
you want to. But I figured I'm not ordering all through the movie. I know what I want.
Yeah.
I want it to come at the beginning of the movie.
So in Lux Light, you can order at the beginning.
Yes.
Okay.
And then they come. And it turns out it's a little freer than that, in that if you order your dessert, they don't bring it right away, so it'll be melty. They'll come back when you... you know, are ready for it. So
they
it's
have
not...
desserts too.
Of course, they have desserts.
Oh,
delicious!
My God, and this is all from
yummy.
Davio's.
Yeah,
Davio's
was yummy.
Is great, great
it was
food.
Very,
yeah,
very good.
Food.
The food, I have to say, was quite excellent. Chairs are very comfy. What I in this rollout, and I, you know, the whole experience is going to be great when I think they get it together. But they weren't very. There's some things that were just not tight enough for me. And if you're paying that kind of money, it needs all to be tight. For example, what is the difference between Lux and Super Lux? Well, I kind of sort of tell you that on the website. But what you don't know is that Lux Light is very close in the front. I think you need to know that in case you're a person that doesn't want to be close to the front.
Yeah.
And that makes a huge difference. Some people came in, did not know that, and they were very upset that they could, at that point, not change because these are reserved seats. So it's like you don't just wander in and sit down. You actually have a seat with a number on it, and you go to it. So I think those kinds of things. And then I had to search very hard to get the details that I wanted about the menu and all of that before. But, you know, I'm a woman of determination. So
you are. You are a woman of extraordinary determination.
So
I think people don't know the half of it.
I did find out, you know, what the menus were and all of that. And if you could order off either menu, no matter what section you were sitting in. And that is true. So I'll answer that question for people who might want it. The best thing about it, You know, it's an adult movie experience. They're cocktails. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, you have to be 21.
Yeah,
you have
well,
to be
of course,
21.
I am 25.
You are,
so therefore
you're 25.
I can...
I'm 28 myself.
So I can work with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's great,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. It's lovely. I think what they're going to have to work on, though, is the content as well. I went to see Man of Steel. That kind of crosses boundaries mm-hmm. and generations. And I think the young kids want to see it and older people wanted to see it. But I think if you do too many of those action movies, they're not, I don't believe, a lot of adults who want to sit through all of that. Man of Steel was a little bit different, but I think you're going to have to pay very careful to how you program that theater.
Our number is 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970 or bpr@wgbh.org. Would this appeal to you? You and your significant other, you and a girlfriend, you and whoever, go out on a Friday night, Saturday night, you pay $28, you sit in the super luxe section.
And you reserve seats.
Oh, you reserve seats.
Oh, yeah, your seats are reserved. You don't wander in and plop down.
Well, okay, because I don't like going to the movies very much uh-huh. anymore because, like I said,
you're fighting for a seat.
Yeah, I feel like Methuselah in there. Everybody's about 12, and everybody's noisy, and they got the and they're supposed to monitor the phones, and they don't.
Nope,
and everybody's texting, and it drives me nuts. Would you like to go and enjoy this experience? It's $28. You get the food is extra, obviously, but it's really not when you think about it. If you go and pay $10 or $12 for a ticket, and then you buy a large popcorn and you buy a couple of sodas, you're up in the $20 area.
That's
anyway. 877-301-8970. Have you been? Maybe you've been to the Showcase Super Lux and the Swank New Movie Theater in the Chestnut Hill area, which is right, of course, next to the mall at Chestnut Hill. I always love that. It's not, you know, a mall. It's not the Chestnut Hill Mall. It's the mall at Chestnut Hill. And you know what? And you know what the Super Lux is located on?
No.
The street.
I never even.
Yes, it's called the street. This is an area across the. Well, not across the street. First, down Route 9, a little bit beyond the street, is the mall at Chestnut Hill. This is a swank spot. Let's put it that way.
No, it is. And the seats are comfy.
The seats are comfy. 877-301-8970. Have you been? Would you like to go? Would this solve one of our big movie woes? When you get to be a little bit over 30 or over 40 for that matter, is going to the movie theater not surrounded by a bunch of obnoxious teenagers texting all night and ruining your theater enjoyment. Joanne Weiss in the Boston Globe on Sunday, she gave it a thumbs up, basically. Mm-hmm. She said one of the problems is because the seats go back, you're eating and you get crumbs all over your outfit.
Well, you can sit up when you eat, and then you can go back again.
Yeah, I don't think I want to eat sitting back.
You can
know what
sit
I mean?
Up, yeah.
And you're around tables, correct?
Yes, there's a little table right in front of you. It's wonderful. It pulls out, kind of like an airplane seat, fancy airplane seat, but it's wonderful.
I think this would be a great first date experience, too. You know why?
Yeah.
Because you don't have to talk to anybody at the
exactly.
movies. But you could sort of look at each other and be at the table and have
you
that.
You could be comfortable.
You could be comfortable
and you
without
can have
having,
a cocktail.
Exactly. without having to make small talk. Did you try the martini? What cocktail did you have?
I had a fancy thing that was delicious.
It was?
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to try two or three others, but you see, their service wasn't right on point just yet. It needs to be exactly on point for VIP service, I believe.
I bet they had great wines at Davio's, too, because that is, they used to be an Italian restaurant.
I did look at the wine list. It was good.
Okay. 877-301-8970. What do you think about the Showcase Super Lux Theater on the street next to the mall in Chestnut Hill? Elaine from Newton, you're at the scene of the crime. Newton, have you been there?
Yes, I went the other morning because I really wanted to check everything out for myself because I read a lot, but I didn't quite get it all. So I went over and I was like the only person in there at 10:40 in the morning. And I think there were really good pluses. And then there were things that I, as a movie lover and a movie goer, could care less about. I mean, if I want to eat, I'll stay home and eat. You know, the chairs were comfortable, yes, but the difference in the $20 ticket and the $28 ticket, the $20 ticket reclines, but the feet don't go up.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Wait, this is the light lux as opposed to super lux?
That's
okay.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah, and just, right. The $28 ticket, I mean, if you're looking for this luxurious feel, it reclines and your feet go up, which is a small point, but I think that is a little more comfortable if you're reclining, that your feet are also up. And the only other thing that I don't think you guys mentioned is for the $28 ticket, your popcorn is free.
That's right.
Much as you want.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a biggie.
That is a biggie.
But, I thought that was big. And the last thing I'll say is, I don't know how fast I'd be running in there for the $20 or the $28 ticket, but what I ended up really liking about it was not the food, because as I said, I don't really care, not the little bar, definitely an adult-looking place, but the fact that it is a reserved seat, like you're going to.
That's a great point.
Yep.
That's a great point.
You don't
point.
Have to go an hour in advance.
Yeah.
Right.
The parking is obviously free. Mm-hmm. You don't have to stand in line. If you're going with, like, a few other people, you don't have to scramble to get your seat and save it and have people give you a dirty look.
Okay. So, okay, I mean, Lane. So it's a modified thumbs up from you. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
okay.
I think everybody should try it once and really see what it's like. For me personally, I don't think I'd be running to go there, you know.
Okay.
More
all right.
Than too many other
okay,
things.
Okay, we got it.
But sometimes.
Elaine, thank you very much. You know, it just occurred to me when Elaine was talking about the full Barker Lounger experience
right.
as opposed to the modified
right.
Barker Lounger. The full Barker Lounger is in the Super
it's
Deluxe
right.
with the legs up. Modified is in the front. You don't get to put the legs up. I talked about the mall at Chestnut Hill. In Natick, you know what they call the mall in Natick?
The mall?
The collection.
Oh, the collection, right. Okay. I don't pay attention to these things.
I mean, isn't this a little over the top? Are you supposed to feel more luxurious when you go to the mall or the collection?
Well, the collection has a lot of high-end stores.
They do
it,
have
so
a lot of high-end stores.
The collection of high-end
and remember
stores.
Remember they built the condos right next to the collection so you could live right at the mall.
Yes.
I'm sorry, you're living at the collection.
Yeah.
In Natick is where you were living. Jane from Groton, what do you think about the Showcase Super Lux Theater, or would you like to go if you haven't been already?
I want to tell you, I love you, Callie, and I love you. I love everybody. I love Jim. I just love this whole show.
Oh, okay. Goodness. Thank you. What do you think about the Super Lux?
I think it's a great idea. I haven't been there. I'm curious as to how much the food was on top of the ticket.
It was not outrageous enough for me to think about it. I mean, it was a reasonably priced, and it was delicious.
How much would you say the whole bill would be for one person?
Probably we were in the Lux Light, so we were 20. So it was probably like 30 something. I mean, it wasn't horrible.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
No, no. And I had a cocktail.
And that's plus the ticket?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not bad.
No, it's not bad. It wasn't horrible. I mean, and I, unlike the previous caller who said food doesn't matter to her, this for me is the ultimate, you know, dinner and a movie experience.
Absolutely.
So when you don't have to cook it, And you have a nice, wonderful cocktail and a lovely seat. What more do you want?
Absolutely. It sounds wonderful, and I'm planning to go.
Jane, thank you very much for the call. So let me get this straight. Callie Crossley, who went to see Superman. That's not what
Man
they call
of Steel.
It. Man of Steel, excuse me. At the Super Lux there at the next to the mall at Chestnut Hill, located on the street at Chestnut Hill. You order your meal. You have the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the meal, they come clear it away.
Oh, yes.
And during the movie, rather.
Yes, during the movie. And they're very, I did not find that distracting. Now, Joanna wrote that she
did.
That at some point, and that was the reason I had tried Super Lux before, and I felt they were a little bit disruptive, actually. So I tried Lux Light because I didn't really want to be interrupted, you know, many times during the meal. They very quietly came and removed the stuff. Then they came back because we ordered dessert and said, would you like your dessert now? But very quietly, and I didn't miss anything, which I loved.
Now, she said, Joanna Weiss, who wrote about this piece in the Globe about the theater, said that it was very distracting for her at a pivotal moment in the movie
right.
when her truffle fries arrived. And could she look at the truffle fries or look at the pivotal point in the movie?
Exactly.
And she said that was a difficult thing. I suppose if you have to do a lot of cutting or paying attention to your food, maybe you're better off with finger food there so you can just kind of shove it right in your mouth.
I suppose that's true.
Okay.
But I didn't, it worked out fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a big advertisement for the Showcase for Lux.
No, they got to get some stuff together now. As I said,
okay.
If it's going to be Lux, Light or Super Lux, everything must be tight, and it's not tight enough
okay.
right now.
I'm going. You know why? Another good reason to go this weekend?
What?
Air conditioning.
Well, that too.
It's going to be 90 degrees. Okay, coming up, it is Open Mic with Charlie Baker. We talk to Charlie Baker every time. What day is this? Tuesday. Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, Charlie Baker's here. We're going to talk to him about Gomez, politics in Massachusetts, a little bit about fireworks as well. Stay tuned for that conversation on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy.
And I'm Marjorie Egan.
And we'd like to thank everyone who supported Boston Public Radio during the June community campaign.
Actually, Jim wanted to thank every one of you personally, but we only have 30 seconds.
Your support means this station will continue to keep this whole community connected to news and information.
And thanks to you, this station will be fundraiser-free for the rest of the summer.
You can still do your part online at WGBHnews.org.
And many thanks.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Boston Conservatory, proud sponsor of the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, solely focused on training the performing arts superstars of tomorrow in dance, music, musical theater, and opera. bostonconservatory.edu. And the Statue of Liberty. Revisit Ken Burns' history of the Statue of Liberty, from her controversial construction to what she represents to all Americans. Don't miss the Statue of Liberty, Tuesday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan, joined by Callie Crossley today. She's the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley every Sunday night at 6:30, filling in for Jim Browdy, who'll be back on Monday. I have two corrections here. Apparently, the collection in Natick has now gone back to the Natick Mall. I guess I thought it was too high. I hope that was from Dennis, an email. I hope you're right, Dennis. And Christopher said that McGill is in Montreal, not Toronto.
Okay.
So I didn't know that. I knew it was someplace up in Canada. It was cheaper. But anyway, joining us on the line right now is Charlie Baker, the former CEO of Harvard Pilgrim and a former and maybe future Republican candidate for governor. Hello, Charlie Baker.
Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm good. You know, Jim is not here today. Callie Crossley is filling in. But I feel as though I would let Jim down if I didn't do what he does every single solitary week, Charlie Baker, which is ask if you would like to announce your candidacy for governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts right here on Boston Public Radio when Jim's not here, and so Callie and I can have the scoop. What do you think, Charlie?
As much as I would appreciate the opportunity to poke Jim in the eye on this one, I'm going to pass. But I must say, that is a unique opportunity. I appreciate the fact that you gave it to me.
Okay. Well, you must have read the front page story in the Globe a couple of days ago, vis-a-vis the gubernatorial race, that Martha Coakley may be giving the race some thought. What do you think? Is she the strongest Democrat to run?
Well, if I learned anything from my own experience, and Marjorie, I think you would probably agree with me on this, is that it's very hard to predict where these things go. And, you know, the front runners aren't necessarily always the ones who end up at the front of the race at the end of the race. And I think that, you know, Martha's, I think everybody would agree that she's done a terrific job of sort of rehabbing her standing in the Commonwealth. And I, in particular, love a lot of the research that her office has put out on healthcare. And I would, she'd certainly be a really strong candidate, but I really hesitate to ever predict any more about what I think is going to happen on this stuff so far away, because stuff happens and things change, you know?
Would she be met with the curse of the woman candidate? One that Elizabeth Warren broke a little bit, but still seems to be hanging over Massachusetts.
Warren broke a little bit. I mean,
all right, okay, a big
in the history of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Knocked it right over.
Okay, but you get my drift, though.
I don't think so. I think, 53% of the people who voted in the 2012 elections in Massachusetts were women. They were a majority of the voting community, and I don't think there's a curse of the woman candidate thing in Massachusetts. I think in some respects. We're past that.
God, I hope so. We've had a pretty dismal record. We're talking with Charlie Baker, who may or may not be running for governor. He's not going to tell us now. Maybe he'll tell us at some point. But the Herald did have a great story.
I would imagine if I were to run, I would have to tell you at some point.
You'd have to tell us at some point. I'm angling for the exclusive here, Charlie. You know what I'm saying? I think there's no finer place to announce your candidacy than right here on WGBH 89.7. It could make me a star, Charlie Baker. You know what I'm saying? And I'm trying to become one.
No one needs to make you a star, Marjorie.
Okay. Charlie, that was very smooth of you. You know, the Herald reported, and I thought this was quite fascinating, that the Republicans were so disheartened by no Gomez win that they may just throw in the towel on a U.S. Senate race altogether. What do you think of that?
First of all, I don't think that's true. And secondly, I think it's an off year, right, in the sense that there's no presidential election in 2014. That by definition, if you look at the historical data and voting patterns in Massachusetts, means it's a better opportunity for a Republican
at any level in a statewide race than a race in a year in which there is a presidential election. So I would imagine that the party will have people who look at that as an opportunity and step forward. I'm not worried about it.
I'm asking everybody. I keep this is a curiosity point for me, Charlie Baker, and that is why the Republican Party, the National Republican Party, and even I guess the local one, didn't come out in a bigger financial embrace of Gabriel Gomez. I recognize that there was some support for him, but whether or not you thought this could be a win, it seems to me, as John King mentioned earlier in our conversation today, that it would be an important investment on several levels, an important investment for the future period, but certainly one that spoke volumes to others looking at the GOP and its future.
Well, I'm obviously from Massachusetts, and I know Gabe, and I think he's a good guy, and I would have liked to have seen the National Party do more. So my point here is I'm sort of a biased witness to begin with. And I haven't talked to anybody at the national level, so I can't really answer that question. I certainly would have thought that Gabe would be an attractive candidate to support. It's a special election. It's not like you have a lot of other places you need to be investing your resources. I do understand that in many cases, you know, the national parties make decisions about where they put their money based on where they think they have their best opportunity to succeed. And a Republican running in Massachusetts is a first-time candidate against a long-term incumbent who has a lot of money in his bank account to begin with wouldn't necessarily be looked at as necessarily a great investment. But in a special, it's a one-timer. I would have thought the National Party would have done more. But again, I'm a biased witness. I'm a big fan of Gabe as a person, and I don't know why they chose not to play more, because certainly there were a lot of reasons that would have made it look like a worthwhile investment.
Did you realize Scott Brown beat Gabriel Gomez in the Cohasset Triathlon over the weekend? I was impressed because Scott Brown's 54 and Gomez is 47. I thought it was a triumph for the man in his 50s over the guy in his 40s.
Well, but the guy in the 40s has been spending the past 3 or 4 months here doing nothing but campaigning. So
that's true.
I think you got to give Gabe a little bit of a break on that, although I will say that since I would have trouble driving the length of a
me
triathlon.
Too. Me too.
Good for Scott. Yikes.
Charlie Baker, let me ask you about something that was on the front page of the Globe today. Smokers will need to shell out about a buck more for a pack of cigarettes, another 3 cents for gas. This is under these provisions of a $34 billion spending bill that was just approved by lawmakers, and Governor Patrick will approve it or not approve it. Of course, the governor wanted a lot more money in new taxes. He's going to get about $500 million. He says that's not enough. But what do you think about this, a buck more? More for cigarettes, 3 cents in taxes, and the $500 million more in taxes, period.
Well, I'm actually kind of surprised that no one's talking about the software tax that was part of that package, which, depending upon how it gets interpreted, could be anywhere from 150 to way north of 150 million in new state revenue. Mike Widmer, who is the head of the Mass Taxpayers Foundation and a pretty temperate guy most
yes.
of the time when he talks about stuff, he basically said that if you wanted to put a dagger into the heart of the future of the Massachusetts economy, you would levy a tax like this on our software and technology industry. And that one has gotten almost no attention at all, and I don't understand why. Because if you look at what really drives the Massachusetts economy for the past decade or so, it's been innovation and new technology. And this one, according to Widmer anyway, is the broadest, deepest, and most expansive tax on software of any state in the United States. And I wish more people were focusing on that part of the equation.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say. I didn't even know Michael Widmer had said that. Who can we blame this on, Charlie Baker? Whose idea was this?
Well, it was the governor's and the legislature's. It was, you know, basically part of the original proposal that the governor made, and the legislature, you know, amended it a bit, but basically adopted it. And it's a big deal. And it's especially a big deal in a state, as you and I have talked before, that hasn't created a single net new job in 20 years.
So if Governor Patrick has this legislation on his desk now intact, he either approves it and the software tax and everything else is included, or he vetoes it, which he's not likely to do, I don't think.
I would be stunned if he vetoed this, to tell you the truth, mostly because there's a lot of, as you pointed out earlier, there's a lot of stuff he wants in there. And the big risk you take when you veto a package you don't think is perfect when it comes out of the legislature is they can always choose to do nothing in response to your veto and basically make the legitimate argument that they put what they considered to be a best-case proposal on the table, and you blew it up, and therefore you, the governor, own the consequences of doing that.
Wow. I'm embarrassed to say I don't know more about this, and I should look into this, because you don't want that industry to be stifled. Hey, Charlie Baker, on a lighter note, it is the 4th of July. I've been asking. It's the 2nd of July. We're closing in on the 4th of July. Day after tomorrow is 4th of July. I wondered if you were running things around here. I mean, we are one of four states in the whole United States that makes fireworks illegal. If you were running things, what do you think, Charlie? Would you give your fellow citizens at least some sparklers on the 4th of July? Should we legalize or at least not make everything criminal, including sparklers in Massachusetts?
I think this is obviously probably one of the most important issues you and I will ever talk
about.
It's
very important.
Everybody who wants to play with the sparklers and the fireworks, they go to New Hampshire, they bring them back, and that for the most part seems to work reasonably well. I don't think it's a big issue, to tell you the truth, one way or the other, and not something I think we should spend a lot of time worrying about.
But aren't we losing at least some revenues to New Hampshire on this?
Oh boy, I mean, compared to the amount of money we lose, because we have a 6.25% sales tax and they have none. I mean, and we have a tax on wholesale tax on liquor and they have none. I mean, there's lots of other places where we lose a lot more money than this one. And this is, the other stuff where we lose money, it's spending that takes place every single day and every single weekend. Here we're talking about something that happens, for all intents and purposes, once a year.
Mm. Will you and the Baker boys and girls be setting off any firecrackers this weekend?
We actually have a big barbecue at our house on the 3rd, because that's when our town always has the fireworks and we'll have all the neighbors over and we'll eat more than we should, and the cleanup process will last well into the 4th.
Okay.
But a good time will be had by all without sparklers.
All right. Well, Charlie Baker, thank you very much. Do you have a dog, by the way?
We do.
Does your dog have a nervous breakdown with the fireworks every year?
The thing that really, it's funny you should bring that up, the thing that really does our dog in more than anything is the amount of available eating that, she literally just patrols the ground and eats everything that anyone drops.
What kind of dog?
Oh, God. She's a cross between a poodle and a schnauzer. She's a little...
Poo schnauzer.
Ooh, how cute is that?
It's called a schnoodle.
A schnoodle, oh.
She probably weighs 15 pounds, and by the morning of the 4th, she'll probably weigh about 20.
Okay. Charlie Baker, I had to buy one of those little thunder coat, firecracker coats for my little dog because he almost had a nervous breakdown last 4th of July, but it doesn't work. So this year I'm going to have to drive up the highway to avoid the fireworks with the dog in the car.
What a good owner you are.
I know. I'm just guilt-ridden. That's what I am, guilt-ridden. Yeah. Charlie Baker, thank you very much, as always, for taking the time to join us. Have a great 4th of July and a great barbecue. Charlie Baker is the former CEO of Harvard Pilgrim and a former, and as we always say here, maybe future Republican candidate for governor. Okay, up next, Wendy Murphy. She's here to talk to us about a great story that was in the Herald today about defendants covering their faces, and also to tell us about the paperback edition of her fantastic new book about justice for some. Wendy Murphy, up next, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is vacationing. I am Marjorie Egan. Callie Crossley is with me. She is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley every Sunday night at 6:30. And in studio is a powerhouse victim rights attorney, Wendy Murphy. I've known her forever. She's also an adjunct professor of law at New England Law Boston. And her book, which has just been reissued in paperback, reissued in paperback, is And Justice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges you hate and the dirty tricks they don't want you to know about. Wendy, thanks for being with us today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
But before we get to your book, I just wanted to ask you something that we had on the front page of the Herald today.
I saw. Good
this
piece.
Thank you. This is becoming sort of a trend here in Massachusetts where defendants come into the courtroom. In this particular case, this was a man who had been accused of assaulting a woman on the Esplanade. The cops arrested him when he was actually on top of this woman on the Esplanade about 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. He bragged to them that he'd beaten a prior rape accusation, and he's in the defendant's docket at the Charlestown District Court with his T-shirt up over his face. This is becoming more and more common, where you see defendants covering up their face. And I did not know this, but it's the judge's prerogative to let them cover up or not cover up.
Well, I disagree with that. I don't think it's the judge's prerogative. And good for the Herald for putting his mugshot in there. So let him cover his face all he wants. The Herald will put the actual face in the newspaper as well it should. No, judges like to think they have the prerogative, but in fact, the First Amendment is quite clear that if you're arrested and charged with a crime and your face and the rest of your body is brought to court, you have no right of any sort, constitutional or otherwise, to cover your face up. And a judge should, and a judge, in my opinion, is required under the First Amendment to command you to pull your shirt down and to show your face, with this big exception, and it's an important exception. If who you are and the identity of the perpetrator is a legitimate dispute, if it's really in dispute whether you are in fact the person who committed the crime or is alleged to have committed the crime, then you file a motion with the court. The court has a hearing. The court sees whether it is a legitimate dispute and can give you permission to shield yourself. And that's reasonable and that's fair.
And that's when they hide behind a wall or something like that. So they're in the courtroom, but you can't see them.
Yeah, but the presumption
is different than this.
Right. But the presumption is the public has a right to know. And it's a high burden to overcome that presumption. So you can't just say, I feel shamed of myself. I think I'd like to cover my face so my mother doesn't see. Mm-hmm. There's no such right. And
right.
So any judge who indulges that, in my opinion, should be challenged, hopefully, by the Herald. I mean, I'd be happy to volunteer to help with that effort. File some kind of action against a judge who does that, and you'll win easily.
Or I'll call my boss right after the show. We're ready to go.
Volunteer me.
I'm really curious about it. If you could articulate an example of when you say there is some dispute, because in those cases where there is some dispute, people don't seem to agree that there's some dispute. So.
Well, right. But judges are very acclimated. I mean, I was a prosecutor for 5 years. Judges are acclimated to define what a, quote, legitimate dispute is, as opposed to just a strategic urge. And you have a hearing. And so if a defense attorney says, look, this crime happened a month ago. My guy has an alibi. He got picked up last night, but we're going to prove he wasn't even there. So please don't put his face out there because, among other things, we're going to challenge this witness's ability to identify him. And we don't want the witness who's going to read the news to look at him and go, yep, that's him, and then get it in her mind that in fact, is him. There's no dispute in this case. And in 99.9% of cases charged, the defendant is guilty of something. That's statistically true because most prosecutors only want to bring charges where they feel confident they can win beyond a reasonable doubt. So one of the things I write about in my book is why it's called And Justice for Some is that the vast majority of rejected cases, what we call declinations, disproportionately are cases involving violence against women and children, often violence against minorities, classes of people who are disproportionately not powerful in society. And so I write in my book about how important it is as a democracy for us to stand up against that and to measure the problem and to say, wait a minute, how come that prosecutor declines 90% of cases involving violence against women brought to his attention, but brings 90% of the drug cases, for example, and aren't people more important than drug crimes and so forth? That's a big part of the theme of my book.
We're talking with Wendy Murphy, who is a victim advocate and attorney and the author of Injustice for Some. So, Wendy Murphy, how come so many judges, I mean, the Herald today, we had a bunch of other cases where people are hiding, not just the so-called perp walk. I mean, that's the other thing where you see sometimes overly gleefully, I think. You see law enforcement yep. parading a defendant who may, of course, be innocent before the media as they go into court. That's different. I'm talking about in the courtroom.
Yeah.
Cases where people in the courtroom are allowed to have shirts over their head or hands over their face or whatever. Why do judges do this? Could they be ignorant of the law? They just don't care. I mean, it's so disrespectful.
I would say you as a journalist and you, Callie, could call that judge up and say, dude, what were you doing? Because
and you know what happens when you call the judge.
You won't get a call back.
You won't get
the judge's representative won't call you back because there is no answer.
Yeah.
The answer is we shouldn't have done it. It was illegal. You caught us. Oops, we won't do it again. And of course, they will do it again because, you know, you can't have C-SPAN in the courtroom, although I think you should. I would love to see C-SPAN-like cameras in every district courtroom in particular.
Oh, how about in the Whitey Bulger courtroom? How devastating is it that we can't see all this parade of serial killers on the witness stand?
Well, and let me say, as a caveat to what I just said about cameras in the courtroom, I don't think we necessarily should have cameras doing gavel-to-gavel coverage of all trials, in part because there is such a risk of media exploitation. And the defense in particular, in my experience, and I write about this a lot in my book, the defense in high-profile cases, especially if the perpetrator is a beloved somebody, using the media to whip the crowd into a frenzy or distract the public from the truth to infect the jury pool. Kobe Bryant, Michael Jackson. I mean, I could go on and on. But the fact is, cameras in the courtroom during the trial, I've got more restraint. I don't have as strong an urge for that because I don't like the idea that you can use the media to distort the truth. And that is a big problem, especially for wealthy people.
But the media in the courtroom for the Whitey Bulger case, I think, would be a fantastic civics lesson in the totally corrupt FBI, which I still have a lot of problems with, even in 2013. And just to see people, I mean, just from a basic curiosity factor, I mean, thank God, very few people are accused of killing 20 people. Very few people are like John Monterano, also, who admitted to killing 20 people, or Kevin Weeks admitted to being by Whitey Bulger and Stephen Fleming that committed these murders. It's a civics lesson. It annoys me as a taxpayer that these judges in the federal court are saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to let you see this. I think we're entitled to see this. You should have to take a day off from work to get down to the federal courthouse.
I don't think we need video images or even photographs of what's going on in the federal court in the Bulger trial because there is a tremendous amount of ink on that case in both Globe and the Herald.
It's different.
It could be different in a different case. I don't think we need it. Look, most of my friends are like, who is that old geezer? Most of the people I know not only don't have a context to appreciate the Bulger case, even though it's incredibly interesting and so important for us to understand how corruption happens, especially at that level. But most of my students, for example, and most of the people who are in my age group or younger, and my kids, for example, they're saying, why are you covering that? That's like a bunch of goons who the geriatric ward. Why aren't they talking about current gang violence, organized crime, corruption today?
Well, you wrote that
today's
in the Herald,
corruption.
A great column the other day about violence in the city.
I think part of that has to do with something that was written, and I'm sorry, I can't remember which reporter did it, about how people don't get what the victimization really cost. That the kid, remember, somebody was running after one of the families in the courtroom saying, oh, was your family involved?
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And the family member said, you know what? This is our life.
Right.
This is not how cool.
Right.
So I think that's,
There's a sexiness to organized crime of that era. There's a romanticism, too, you know. A lot of people did think of Bulger as like a lot of those kinds of bosses back then, whether it was the Angelos or the Bulger clan. They did a lot of nice things for their communities in addition to killing people and, you know, running drugs. So I do think we romanticize because we have the distance in time, but also because that was a different era for organized crime. It's not at all romantic these days. And that's all I'm saying is, I don't want to overly romanticize the past.
Remember
I'd
the
like
cheese
to talk
man
about today.
From the North End, he wasn't
Nunziano,
a very romantic character, the cheese man. Well, let's talk about, you mentioned this in the Boston Herald. We're talking with Wendy Murphy, by the way, a victims advocate and the author of the book, And Justice for Some. You wrote about this in the Herald, the disproportionate coverage of Aaron Hernandez's case, you know, the classic lines become, and Joan Vernanke said it, and I sort of said it in different ways, that you know how to get a coverage of a black man getting killed in Dorchester, make sure he's killed by someone that's
so
famous.
It's so true. Yeah.
But beyond that, and there has been disproportionate coverage, I mean, nobody's going to argue that. What do you think about the legal chances of Aaron Hernandez beating the rap? Well, I should say allegedly beating the alleged rap.
I do think there's a lot we don't know. I wrote my piece for the Herald about the coverage because I have never heard of Aaron Hernandez. I was like, who the hell is that?
Me too.
I never heard of
him. I didn't know he was either.
I have never heard of him in my life, ever.
Big sports fans, I guess, girl.
And I was a cheerleader for the Patriots, but I also didn't pay attention then because I was much more interested in cartwheel. But I hadn't heard of Kobe Bryant.
I knew Kobe Bryant.
I hadn't before he was charged with rape. I just don't cover, you know, sports is not my thing. But the fact that it got wall-to-wall coverage, I think one of the good things about over-coverage when it comes to a person of wealth, power, and influence is it's harder to bag the case. It's harder for corruption to make it all go away. It's not impossible. We watched that with, speaking of Kobe Bryant and Michael Jackson, but it's going to be harder. And I read the evidence thus far released about Hernandez. It's not only very overwhelming, and it appears one of them has already turned, because how else would there have been evidence about what was said in the car on the way to the... which is pretty deadly, because if you've got one of... If only a couple people know what happened and one of them is a rat, you've got a very strong case. But that said, you know, for me, covering it a lot means that even though he has whatever amount of money, millions of dollars, he's not going to be able to make it go away. He may do some shenanigans. He can pay experts to say that up is down and black is white, and he may end up with second degree murder instead of first. But it sounds like the case, even before they brought it, was rock solid, because prosecutors don't want to be embarrassed. You don't want to bring charges too fast against a guy with that amount of money, because he's going to hire a lawyer that's going to make the prosecutor the focus of the defense strategy. Oh, rush to judgment, or, you know, cops did this wrong or whatever. They had everything locked up nice and tight in terms of what I read came out at the bail argument. To have your case that solid at the day of the bail argument, boy, you must be very, very confident.
Wendy Murphy, I know that you do not cover sports and you're not really interested in sports, but I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you have done a lot of investigation on domestic violence issues in sports. Have you not?
Yeah. I mean...
Is it worse? I mean, we know that there's been a lot of arrests of NFL players since the Super Bowl, but is domestic violence among professional athletes any more significant than it is among the general populace?
You know, my sense is that it's not necessarily more prevalent, but it is certainly more problematic, because especially if you're good and not a terrible player, if you're a terrible player, they dump you for, you know, winking at your wife in the wrong way. But if you're a good player, you get lots of passes. Yeah. So I think it's more reported. I wouldn't call it more prevalent, with this exception. The use of steroids obviously changes the calculus a little bit. And entitlement and aggression, you know, those are particularly volatile factors that we see in all domestic violence relationships. But I think the downside of over-publicizing when famous, especially athletes, get in trouble is that we then forget that it's happening in everybody's home. You know, I once said something to, I won't name him because I like him, but a political person in my area where I live in Middlesex County. He knocked on my door. We had a talk, and I was talking about child rape and child pornography and domestic abuse. And I said, you know, you don't do anything on these issues. I'm never going to vote for you ever unless you do something. And he said, well, you know, that's really not a problem in this town, is it?
Oh, my God.
You know, and he was sincere.
He was a prosecutor?
No, but he was an elected official. Okay. He was sincere. And I think what he really meant was, it doesn't seem like a problem because people aren't reporting it. Women aren't telling it. I said, that's exactly the problem. In a middle class neighborhood, the problem is still huge. But the women often don't tell because they stand to lose so much more. They stand to lose their home, their lifestyle, their wealth. Whereas in some ways, the very liberated poor, they have the government in their space all the time, from DSS to cops running up the street. So in some ways, they tell more. And then we get the false sense that the data suggests there's more violence in poor communities, or because of reporting that there's more violence among athletes. In fact, I think there's a tremendous amount of unreported domestic abuse and child sex abuse and child porn in middle class and wealthy communities.
We're speaking with Wendy Murphy. She's the adjunct professor of law at New England School of Law. I thought it was New England School of Law.
It was. We changed her name at our 100th anniversary.
So now
a couple
it's New
years
England
ago.
Law.
New England Law Boston.
Okay. I'll call it New England Law Boston
Thank
by its
you.
New and correct
My
name.
Dean will love you.
And you just had come out in the paperback version, Injustice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges you hate, dirty tricks they don't want you to know about. It is for the uninitiated. It's a tough book because you talk about how people pick dumb jurors and how blaming the victim goes on still in 2013, and DNA lies, and people get off, and all this kind of stuff. But you wanted to talk about one particular aspect, I know, of your book, now out in paperback.
Well, because I wrote And Justice for Some to give voice to issues and cases that don't have access to the media. The voices don't have the power to get, especially the networks, to pay a lot of attention to the truth. And it frustrates me. I've been a pundit, as you know, for 20 years, worked on all the networks. I'm still on all the networks all the time, but I can't get anybody to let me say what needs to be said about, for example, the JonBenet Ramsey case. And that case I've covered from the beginning, and it has frustrated me. So I've updated my book substantially, and one of the key things I did was update the Ramsey case because, remember, this child died a horrible death in 1996. It didn't
was
come
she
out.
She
was 6 years old.
6 years old.
It
okay.
didn't come out, found in the basement of her home in Boulder, Colorado. It didn't come out until 2013, right before my paperback came out. So I write about it, that the parents were indicted in her death. The parents were indicted in 1999, 3 years after the child died. We, the public, didn't find out about it until 2013. How wrong is that? And why I care about this case, it's not that...
Mother's dead now, right?
The mother's dead.
Yes.
But it's not that I think her case is so important. It's that she, in my opinion, is a symbol of all children who die from abuse in their own home. And if we don't know the truth about what happened to her, how can we then use the right context and have the right stuff in our brain to assess information we hear about when other little girls, especially little cute girls, end up dead in their own homes or dead in a swamp or disappear from their houses in the middle of the night? Because it really is, I think, epidemic in this country with regard to sexual abuse and child pornography in particular. And one of the stories I tell that some people remember, some don't, involves how that all became so quiet, so silent, how we all became distracted away from the obvious reality, which is that the parents were involved, to some kind of boogeyman.
Oh, we should point out they haven't been convicted here.
No, of course not. No, right. We all know that, too. But we also shouldn't be thinking it was a boogeyman. So one of the – I don't know if you remember when John Mark Carr, this guy from Thailand, got picked up and he confessed. This was about six years ago or so. So I was on Chris Matthews. I was on all the shows because people knew that I had a great depth of knowledge about the evidence in the case. And Paula Zahn's people called me and said, will you come on and talk about how they're going to prosecute John Mark Carr? And I said, I'm not going to come on and say that because that's not going to happen because he didn't do it. And I'm not going to lie. Oh, well, just come on. Paula knows you know the case. Come on. And I said, look, I'll come on, but I'm not going to say that. Okay. Okay, good. Just come on. So anyway, they have me on, me and Jeffrey Toobin, who is a very smart guy, awesome guy. But Paula goes to Jeffrey. Jeffrey, how are they going to prosecute John Mark Carr for the murder of JonBenet Ramsey? Well, they're going to marshal together the confession with some of the evidence and the DNA and the underwear, which was a bunch of nonsense. And Paula says, Wendy, what do you think of Jeffrey's analysis? I said, well, it's good analysis if there were such evidence, but there isn't. And even if they could prove that he had something to do with it, they'd have to disprove the Ramseys didn't do it, which is impossible because there's a mountain of evidence against them. And I start ticking off. The child had old vaginal injuries, new vaginal injuries. I mean, her genitalia was a mess. And whoever, I know this is a tough issue.
It's a very tough issue.
We got to suck it up. If we're going to help protect kids, we got to get out of our comfort zone on this story, okay? If she had old and new genital injuries, then whoever killed her had ongoing intimate access. It wasn't a boogeyman. But then I talked about the first three search warrants in the case were for child pornography on John's computers, okay? So I start ticking all this stuff off, at the end of which poor Paula Zahn goes, ah! You know, you just see her eyes bulge out of her head. She goes, we're gonna take a break. We go to a commercial, and I'm very proud of myself because I got so much out in 30 seconds. I take my earpiece out. And my phone rings. My cell phone rings, and it's a 404 area code, which is Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I was up in Boston on an uplink. I thought, oh, my goodness, somebody at CNN is angry that I said the word vagina on the air.
Why don't you say it a few more times, Wendy?
Hey, you're supposed to be a feminist.
Yeah, I know. So I went to the play.
So it wasn't CNN. It was John Ramsey's lawyer, Lynn Wood, in the green room at CNN, just about to start his appearance on Larry King Live to talk about the same issue. He goes, Wendy Murphy, this is Lynn Wood. I just heard you accuse my client of molesting and killing his own daughter. If I ever hear you say that again, you won't be ex-prosecutor Wendy Murphy. You'll be defendant Wendy Murphy in my lawsuit. Check my record. And I was so offended that he called me and was in my space. He was in my ear. He had no permission to call me, and he was threatening me. I was so offended, I said, check your record? Kiss my ear. You know what I said. And then I said a lot of other words that start with
okay,
F.
Okay, what's the end of the story? What's the end of the story?
The end of the story is in why I write about this in my book. And I was so angry. I said, oh, not only am I not going to stop telling the truth, I'm putting everything you just said to me in my book. And it is in my book. I said, you don't get to bully the truth out of the public airwaves. When it comes to the death of a child, when the parents are the suspects, if the parents weren't the suspects, they'd be pounding the pavement demanding justice. When the parents are the suspects, somebody else has to pound the pavement for the voiceless
child. Here's my
child.
Advice to everybody that's listening to this right now. You have any problems? This is the woman to call. This is the woman to call, a passionate defender of victims, a passionate defender of women and obviously children who are the victims of terrible, terrible crimes. Wendy Murphy, thank you.
Thank you both
very much. And I want to tell you again, the name of the book, which is a pretty upsetting
book. And you can get it at WendyMurphyLaw.com.
WendyMurphyLaw.com. It is a great read, although an upsetting read, is Injustice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges you hate and the dirty tricks you don't. They don't want you to know about. Wendy Murphy, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. Okay, coming up on a lighter note, Boston Wine School's Jonathan Alsop will help us select the best wines to celebrate with this 4th of July. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
America has long thought of itself as the place where anybody can rise through hard work and education, but now many fear that's not true.
Do you know how important your zip code is to giving you access to a quality education?
We'll talk with a roundtable of education innovators who want the reality to match up with the ideal. That's next time on Tell Me More special broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. If you're looking for summertime must-see, must-hear, must-do, the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau can make it easy with Summer Selects Boston. More info at bostonusa.com. An innuendo in Natick with the Hunter Douglas Lighter Side of Living event, featuring cordless LightRise Blackout Duet Arcatella, as well as motorized shades controlled from your smartphone. innuendo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Callie Crossley is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. The guy across from me doesn't think I remember him from the Halloween fairs at the schools where I remember you, Jonathan Alsop. You may not remember me. Anyway, Jonathan Alsop is the owner of the Boston Wine School, and today he's going to join us to tell us about the best wines to celebrate the 4th of July. Thank you very much. Now, I want to tell everybody who's going to be, people are going to be writing furiously. This is all going to be posted on our website so you can get all this. Yeah, if you don't get it, if you're driving, you can't pull over and write down all these great suggestions. Where's my pen so I can write them down?
So yeah, don't try to remember anything. Never worked.
You know, I want to be a cool person that serves the correct wine on. But you know something? Let me just, before you tell us about 4th of July wines,
sure.
I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
You did tell me something, and I didn't even know you're the same guy that went to the same school as my kid. You told me a long time ago, I think it was on Callie's show, about the $2.99 cheap Chardonnay at Trader Joe's.
Yes, the Charles Shaw, the two
you
buck
are
chuck.
A genius. It is delicious.
I am?
Yes. You know why? Because
hey, you know, I don't make that wine. I mean, just for the record.
But I just want to point that if you were looking, if you were someone like me who has a half a glass of wine with dinner, I can't have anymore because I'll fall asleep. But you have a half a glass of wine, you don't want, and the wine sits in your refrigerator for 6 days.
Right.
And you want a cheap wine, yes. right? But it's a drinkable cheap
well,
wine. It is
you
great.
Know, especially the Chardonnay has been great. The other wines,
not so good.
Well, the red wines, I can't really exact. I can tell they're different, but you know they're all kind of like indistinguishable red wine. But somehow this Charles Shaw Chardonnay, I mean, they don't need any, you know, they don't need any publicity.
Any
but you know,
not
that,
everyone may
that
know
Chardonnay,
this.
That Chardonnay has just
two
been
buck chuck
a real
pretty well known.
Yeah. $2.99 I think it is. It's a buy.
Yeah.
So what about 4th of July?
4th of July. First of all, we're looking at barbecue wines. And by barbecue, I don't mean, you know, real barbecue. I mean, like, you know, grill
yes, that's
barbecue.
That's right. Be correct.
Hot dogs, hamburgers, that kind of thing.
Grilled foods.
You know, one thing that, and I brought something for us to taste here, actually. and this is a little counterintuitive for people, because what I brought is a slightly sweet Riesling.
I love Riesling.
Which goes great with smoky foods, grilled food. That slightly sweet Riesling thing and the smoke of the grill makes a fantastic combination. Shall
or
I open
spice.
Shall I open this, ladies?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Please.
Oh,
so this
or
is
spice.
Some,
he's got little
this
cups
is,
and everything.
This is a German Riesling. It's the Dragonstone Riesling.
Okay, I'm writing that
and,
down.
And it's named for an almost completely intact pterodactyl fossil that was excavated on the vineyard. So in German, it's called Drachenstein, which means exactly the same thing, dragon stone. When they excavated this thing, of course, they understood it to be a dragon, and that's where the vineyard gets its name from. And
how
I think
neat.
And I think you're going to be able to taste a little pterodactyl
in
here. A lot of people are using that synthetic pterodactyl, but this is
the real deal.
This is the real thing.
Okay,
so.
That's very exciting.
We should know that Riesling is also very good with spicy
yes.
foods, too. So a spicy barbecue sauce, real barbecue,
would be good.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of sweetness to it. Okay, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah,
am I supposed
spice.
To stir my cup,
no,
or is that an affectation that you,
know you
sometimes
what?
See it, at snazzy restaurants?
It is a gigantic affectation.
Oh, good.
We teach it and do it at the wine school.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, you know, we're just enjoying life here. So just taste this and enjoy it.
That's pretty
this
good,
is
Jonathan.
Great.
I, right, and sweet, but also zippy at the same time. You know, it's got, when, in the wine world, we talk about this thing called, you know, balance in a wine. We'll say, this wine's really balanced.
How much is this? This is
between $15 and $20
That's not too
a bottle.
Bad.
No.
No.
Jonathan always has very reasonable wine picks.
Well,
yeah.
we live, as Marjorie, as you pointed out, we live in a golden age of cheap wine. So,
why do we live in a golden age of cheap wine?
Well, part of it's technology. Part of it is, you know, our ability to understand now where to plant what. I'm going to be visiting my mom in South Carolina at the end of this week, and on my way back, I'm going to visit a couple of wineries in North Carolina.
I did not even know there were wineries.
Every state in the country has wineries.
North Carolina has 75 plus, and we're talking wineries, not vineyards that grow grapes that maybe don't make wine. 75 plus wineries in North Carolina. Virginia is huge. Kentucky has 65.
Virginia's a rival to California.
Kentucky, in which two-thirds of the counties are
Look
in some way are in
Kelly
some way
knows
dry,
everything over there.
Has 65 vineyards and wineries.
Yeah.
It's just
what about
Massachusetts? The South is going to be dozens.
Yes.
The South is going to be huge as we start to understand what to plant where. And what likes to grow where, and you know, we're understanding that much, much, much better. So it's less of a crapshoot where you plant, you know, a few rows of everything and then see what dies. I mean, today we understand what to lead with and what to plant. And so that's part of it. I mean, we're growing more vines, making more wine, getting more grapes, you know, getting more wine out of each acre.
So where should we go in Massachusetts?
Well, there's a ton of places in Massachusetts. I mean, if you're going out to the end of the Cape, out towards Provincetown, there's Truro.
Fabulous wine.
Truro Vineyards, really good wine, really super committed to quality. I mean, they grow a lot of their own grapes, but they also have relationships with other vineyards and wineries that grow grapes. Westport Rivers.
Oh, I knew about that.
Which is down. Yes. Yeah, yes. Which great sparkling wine. Also great Riesling. They're down, you know, as you're headed towards Horseneck Beach.
That's
on
right.
88.
I'm getting far afield, though. I'm getting far afield here. I'm supposed to be talking about Fourth of July wines.
But I think what you're getting at, which
what am I getting at?
Well, is that you know, the story of wine is the story of people saying, you know, name the place, it'll never happen. Oregon, never happen. Washington,
great wines.
Never happen. Well, you know, when I was a boy, people would say things like, "Well, California, you know." They make some alcoholic beverages from grapes, but, you know, it's never really going to be the thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ancient Romans said this about southern France. They said, France, are you insane? It's going to take 1,000 years. And, you know, it did. But, you know, this is the story. So when we hear North Carolina, when we hear Virginia, when we hear Kentucky, when we hear Massachusetts or Rhode Island, or
I just came back from New Mexico.
New Mexico,
the most well-respected sparklings in the country made there.
Yeah,
always on wine lists.
Yeah.
And those people, the original family, refused to go to California. The climate wasn't right for sparkling.
Mm. Yeah,
they let's get back to the reason we're supposed to be talking about
freedom of wine.
That Fourth of July wine. So we have one, the Dragonstone Riesling.
Yep. Another thing I like about this is it's only 10.5% alcohol. So compared with like a 13 or 14% alcohol wine, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a big difference, but we're talking 25% less alcohol.
Right, so you can drink more before you disgrace yourself.
Right. Yeah, or you can not disgrace yourself.
Right.
Which, you know, is kind of a strategy we're always trying to always trying unsuccessfully to pursue.
That is true. So any other...
So I like that it's a little lower alcohol.
Yep.
So in terms of a red wine, I mean, you know, Callie, you're a huge fan of the Pinot Tire.
I love it. Just had a fabulous one.
Which one?
Starts with an L, Envision Sore or something, Flusivore or something.
Okay.
It was fabulous.
Okay. So Pinotage, a grape from South Africa, very smoky, very funky, very earthy, you know, a really strong red wine.
Made to stand up
to strong red meat and smoke. One that I had recently that I really liked is called Barista.
Yeah, that
have
was
you
good one.
Have you had this one?
Yes,
Barista Pinotage.
After the Starbucks people?
Well, you
I
know,
don't think so. But.
they named it for the fact that it has kind of a you could call it coffee in terms of what it smells like. Mm-hmm. It has kind of a roasted, you know, all of this smoky, funky. You know, it has kind of a roasted grain flavor. So that's why they called it Barista. Great Pinotage. I think it's about $15.
Always
too,
inexpensive.
So, yeah.
Always.
Those are great. You know, those, you know, strong red, you know, big red food goes with big red wine. And that's how we figure that out.
And how do you know if you're having a barbecue and lots of asar with the burgers and the hot dogs? When you go into the liquor store, how do you know, or the wine store, how to find the big red wine?
Yeah, well, you know,
because lots of times I feel like they don't know either, and they're just telling me things.
Well, you know, there might be a little bit of that going on. I mean, one of the things that is hard for us to do, because we don't really, as Americans, grow up with this kind of wine culture, is to be able to go into a wine shop and say, "Look, I'm having big red meat. I want big red wine. What have you got that's really, you know," and have this conversation. Don't talk about wine. Talk about you. You know, here's what I like. Here's what I drink. Here's what I'm eating. Here are the people who are coming. Here's what their personalities are like. I know this is very counterintuitive, but you know, the secret of wine is that it's not about the wine.
It's about the experience.
The experience, the
That's
people,
right.
the food, the circumstance, why you're all there. I mean, you know, is it your favorite grand uncle's wake, or did somebody get a promotion? You know, what's the emotional quality of how you're going to be drinking and enjoying this wine? A lot of people can't talk about wine because the language is so imprecise and freaky, but people can talk about themselves and food and what's going on, and that's what we help people learn how to do at the wine school.
But, you know, it is funny as someone like myself who obviously doesn't know anything about wine. You will go to – I remember going to a friend's house actually, I probably can say this on the air. Cheryl Julian writes for the Boston Globe. Her husband is a wine expert.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I was going to a dinner party that she was going to be at, and I felt, well, I got to get some wine. And I thought – I better get some good wine because he's a wine. I don't want to bring some. I'm not going to bring the $2 Chardonnay from Trader Joe's.
So he's probably had it.
But why not?
Because why not? Was intimidated. I didn't want to seem like a rube. You know what I mean? So I go to this liquor store in Brookline on Harvard Street. Looks like an upscale place. And I ask him, I said, I was going to really splurge. I was going to spend like $30 for a bottle of wine. And I got to tell you, this wine was awful. It was awful. It was awful. I thought, did they take advantage of me at the liquor store, or did they?
You know what? Here is one of here is one of the problems with spending a lot of money on a bottle of wine.
What?
You don't know.
Let's say you're a Pinot Noir lover. That's a light red wine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you buy a Cabernet. That's a heavy red wine, and you spend a lot of money on it. It's going to be even heavier, even stronger, even more like itself. So if you're buying the wrong wine that's not to your taste and you spend a lot of money, you're making that wine more and more wrong for you.
Yeah.
Is that making any sense?
Tasted like syrup.
It's
not your flavor profile.
It was not flavor profile.
Exactly.
You would have been better telling him what you like to drink.
I would have been better.
Yeah.
And I don't have a flavor profile.
Yes, you do.
So in general,
I want to challenge your assertion, which everyone asserts that they do not know anything about wine. I believe that you know much more about wine than you think you do, and like all of us, are intimidated by, you know, the cult of experthood.
Yeah.
And that in order to say, hey, this is what I like. Hey, I want another glass. I want something different. People feel like you have to have a PhD in wine to be able to do that.
Okay, John Van Alsop, we only have a couple of minutes left here.
Okay.
Actually, like a minute and a half. So give your advice to people that are going to a barbecue and want to not, you know, have the best wines in the world, but just want to be presentable when they show up at their friend's house. Besides the Dragon Star Riesling and
You know, wear a tux, first of all. And I'll tell you, we had, and I know that people are not going to believe this, but the next big thing is good wine in a box.
Yeah,
okay?
That's right.
Good wine in a box. I just want to really recommend the Big House. Big House
Writing
lines.
That down.
There's Big House Red, Big House White, Big House Pinot Grigio, Big House, Wicked. I think they call it Wicked Old Vines Zinfandel.
Pretty good.
It's
Zinfandel's
it's
great.
Very good. It's wine that you can also buy in a bottle, and it's that level of quality wine, except it's in a box. It's not a box shaped box.
Would you
it's
want
like
it
an octagonal
box.
It's a
box.
Picnic. It's light.
Well,
first
of all, it's two bottles in a box. And it's easy to transport. You can keep it cool. You can chill it down and, you know, toss it in the car.
Okay.
You can take the bag out of the box and tape it onto your torso if you're going and run a little tube up through your shirt. I mean, these are just stories I've heard.
I'm
sure it's really possible to do.
Okay.
But it's just extremely flexible delivery system. And it keeps the wine fresh because it's like the Playtex baby bottle. You know, it's a bag that's collapsing, so you're not bubbling any air back in it.
Okay.
So it doesn't go bad. It stays fresh longer.
And people can also go to visit you at the Boston Wine School and learn all about wines.
Boston Wine School, BostonWineSchool.com.
I'm set. I've got my Dragonstone Riesling. I'm all set with that. And my Wicked Old Vines. What's it called? The Big House. The Big House.
Big House Wines.
Okay. Yeah. Jonathan Alsop is the owner of the Boston Wine School, and he was very gracious to talk to myself, who knows nothing, and Callie, who knows everything, apparently. Over there about the best wines for 4th of July. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for being with us.
Thank you, ladies.
And just so you know, we'll post a full list of Jonathan's recommendations at our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. This is BPR, of course. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is going to be back on Monday. Callie Crossley has graciously helped me out today. You can hear her every Sunday night at 6:30 on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Thank you very much for listening to Boston Public Radio. We'll be back tomorrow at noon.